Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I am Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Opium is an awkward commodity. For the West, it's a reminder of some of the shadier and best forgotten parts of its history. For China, and maybe a few other countries, it's a symbol of national humiliation, best left to the past, unless it needs to shame a foreign country. But the opium trade survived for decades after the Opium Wars, through to the end of the Second World War. How did this trade actually work? How is it possible to trade a good that was at best tolerated in the strange gap between legal and illegal? This trade is what Peter Thilly covers in his book, The Opium Business, A History of Crime and Capitalism in Maritime China, published by Stanford University Press last year. Peter Thilly is a professor of history at the University of Mississippi. He is currently also working on a global microhistory of the 1853 small sword uprising. Today, Peter and I talk about opium, how people traded this quasi-legal good, and how it changed, including a surprising source of illicit drugs in the region. So, Peter, thank you for coming on the show today. You know, I want to maybe talk about how the opium trade maybe not quite gets its start, but gets its start after the Opium Wars, when China is defeated and is forced to kind of open up its ports to the West. How does the opium trade then get rooted in China kind of in that initial period?
Sure, absolutely. And thanks so much, Nicholas, for having me on. It's exciting to be on this podcast, which I've listened to for a while now. So what happens after the Opium Wars, right? How does the opium trade get rooted? It's a fascinating moment. The trade had built up illegally, at least on the import end, into China for decades, and really expanded just incredibly in the 1830s before the war. And the treaty that concluded the Opium War didn't mention the drug, right? It was not legislated in any clear way. And so they opened these five treaty ports to British, you know, trade and commerce and British consuls and things like that. And you have now in each of these ports, these new diplomatic relationships have to be sort of forged between these British consuls and the local Chinese officials. And it's usually a collection of a couple, right? Like a Daotai, a circuit intendant, maybe a couple others. And they have to together figure out what to do about this, what to do about the fact that the biggest, highest volume import trade is still doesn't have a legal framework around it. And so they just decide to take the easy way for that decade and a half and keep it the way it had been operated in the 1830s illegally before the Opium War, on ships offshore outside of the port. Except in Shanghai, they had a kind of river system set up that I don't talk about in the book. But in the other ports, they used receiving ships, which were, you know, big, giant, kind of usually not that seaworthy, kind of old but big ships that you could anchor for months and months and have smaller, better ships bring opium to them and carry the silver away. And so it was on these ships that the Chinese merchants would come out and buy opium. And as in the 1830s, there's something in between corruption and taxation surrounding that in terms of a state regulatory framework. There were officials who sent delegates out to these ships and stamped the chests of opium for paying fees. And a lot of this stuff was negotiated and fairly standardized as the way we think of kind of taxation. So that's really sort of how it gets rooted, is in this kind of moment where neither the British or the Qing want to kind of force the issue in the 1840s after the war. The British aren't going to demand the sort of open recognition of the opium trade at that moment, and the Qing aren't going to demand the abolition of it at that moment. So really what happens is that bribery corruption turns into formal taxation, especially in the 1850s and the crisis of the Taiping Rebellion and assorted kind of uprisings, this fiscal crisis, as also dealing with the indemnity, all this money owed the British after the Opium Wars. So, you know, we're out of money, and here's the largest import trade that we have. How about we start taxing it? And so that's when you have these various kind of schemes of taxation start to evolve in the late 1850s. And once that happens, it's really sort of firmly rooted. The state needs the revenue. They've got relationships with key opium merchants, and business really starts to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it really is funny where, again, you have these ships out in the harbor, and like everyone knows what they're doing, but everyone's kind of maybe turning a blind eye. It's a fascinating interaction between the Western countries and, I guess, both China, but also local Chinese officials.
It really is a local story. You know, it's preferable. I think, you know, it's like hard to sort of quantify, but I think local officials liked that system better than after it became co-opted by the central state, because they got to keep the revenue local, right? And that was always a problem, is once the central state in Beijing gets an interest in, you know, forms of taxation, they're shipping the money out of the province. And so in those early years, when it's kind of on that line, you know, the admiral or whoever, a naval official who's collecting some of these fees can use it to pay his soldiers when instead of having to ship it off to Beijing or something. So it is really very much a local versus national revenue story as well.
I mean, speaking of revenue, I mean, there's a term that pops up a couple times in your book, and I'm going to ask you to actually define it for me, which is tax farming. So what exactly was this system of tax farming, and how did that connect to the opium trade?
Sure. Tax farming is sort of a shorthand for kind of a variety of related systems that you could talk about in a more kind of modern term as privatization, right, of tax collection. I mean, I think there's key differences, but one of the examples I always think of is like the state of Illinois in the U.S., right? The toll collections on the highway got privatized several decades ago, where the state was like, we're not going to collect these taxes anymore. We will hire a private company to collect them for us. And that's sort of what we're talking about here. In the 19th century, it was especially across Asia common to have commodity-based tax farms. So like if the state wants to tax, you know, a certain industry, it's just easier to find the wealthiest merchants participating in that industry and kind of negotiate a quota with them of how much they have to pay a year. And that's the kind of origin of this for opium in various parts of Southeast Asia. So in British Penang and Singapore, and in, you know, across the kind of Netherlands Indies, opium taxation, thinking about the distribution of opium, right? You can tax opium in a lot of different ways. And I'm talking here about the actual, like a retail tax, right? If you go to the opium den, how much the proprietor of that opium den sort of has to pay up, right? Those are run by tax farms, these kind of retail taxes. And they're sort of these territorial monopolies where they control the import of opium into that territory and sell it at a fixed rate and are responsible to pay out to the state a quota per year. So those are auctioned off in most of Southeast Asia, especially British and Dutch colonies. And the people who are buying those tax farms in the Netherlands Indies and the British colonies tend to be either from coastal southern Fujian, where the story in my book takes place, or you know, the area around Hong Kong. Once the opium trade becomes legalized in the late 1850s, or the Qing state is looking for methods to kind of tax opium in various ways, this sort of comes together, right? And China has its own sort of related types of tax farms that have existed. But I really do think it's the sort of expertise of these returned folks from Southeast Asia that kind of build this into the these legion farms, opium legion of the transport tax farms of the 1850s, 60s, and 70s. So they work along the similar lines to the ones in Southeast Asia. They're auctioned off every year for a quota, usually to a prominent merchant or coalition of merchants. And then, and what the sort of the rub is in the book, one of the problems that this creates is that they have sort of a lot of authority, right? You privatize policing in a way by doing this. These guys have their own giant police forces, and they're trying to prevent smuggling. And whose smuggling are they trying to prevent? It's their competitors, right? Because the people who own the tax farm are opium merchants. So it blends kind of commerce and statecraft in a way that I think is ends up being kind of unproductive, I guess I would say.
And I mean, what are like non-Chinese governments' attitude to all of this? I mean, you always get the sense that it's if you was it after the Opium Wars where they forced the issue, it then becomes a very, I think, at best arm's length relationship. But what is actually kind of the attitude of foreign governments towards this opium trade?
It's really varying. It's very, you know, hypocritical, certainly. A lot of times, you know, I'm especially familiar when we talk about foreign governments with the consuls, with the people, you know, the representatives of foreign governments in China and what they're saying and what they're thinking about. And they can't complain enough about these tax farms and that they're unmodern and that they're a stain and that they'll need to be wiped out for China to modernize and things like that. And what's sort of like, what they never seem to acknowledge is that the British government is doing the same thing in their colonies. So that is always sort of confusing to me, right? Like how there can be this cognitive dissonance among these consuls, you know, referring to a practice that their own government uses, as like peculiarly Chinese and unmodern, right? So there is that sort of like racist disdain as part of it. There's so many varying. It's hard to summarize like attitudes of foreign governments because of how big they are and how diverse they are, right? You've got missionaries who are against the opium trade from the beginning, and they're influential, right? And there's also big business, and they like opium, and they hate anybody who talks about opium being sort of a moral responsibility of the British or something, right? So generally speaking, those British who defend the opium trade put all of the blame on what they call like Chinese smugglers and corrupt Qing officials. So there's that sort of strain as well, kind of circulating among foreign officials and foreign governments that like the problem really is that the Chinese government is corrupt, not that the British began this enormous illegal trade into China. So there's all these different kind of things that circulate. But I think over time, the consensus is towards centralization. Tax farms, eventually get abolished in Southeast Asia and in favor of centralized state monopolies and with a goal of eventual prohibition. So you get this kind of compromise between the people who need to make money off of opium, the states that need to make money, revenue off of opium, and the promise that eventually it will go away.
So kind of as we kind of move through the history of this period, we start seeing synthetic drugs pop up. I'm thinking of like morphine, cocaine, I think, mm-hmm. is part of this too, right? I mean, how do these synthetic drugs change the dynamics of the drug trade in China and I guess East Asia more broadly?
Yeah, they really change a lot of things. You know, there's other people who've written about consumption, right? That stuff is really different, right? Opium smells. Morphine is quiet, right? You can do it more secretively. So there's all that sort of stuff involved. But like in terms of the buying and selling of it, it's really interesting in Fujian, the patterns that happen. Morphine is popular in Fujian, and people use it, and there's just a million preparations coming from Taiwan. Locally, there's a morphine factory in Jinjiang County that runs for 20 years, employs like 400 people. They have bicycles that they deliver with. So there's locally produced morphine, you know, stuff coming from all over. The cocaine, it fits in really differently. There's a huge amount of cocaine that goes through the city of Xiamen, but almost none of it stays there. It gets brought in from Taiwan and packaged and then exported to South and Southeast Asia, especially South Asia, India, as well as Burma and Bangladesh. So there's this coastal southern Fujian has this, you know, diasporic connection to Southeast Asia. And so cocaine kind of emerges as like one way to make money, right? There's people who sell it in Xiamen. You can smuggle it into Singapore and sell it to somebody who will take it on to Southeast Asia or South Asia and make you know, a good deal of money. But nobody's using it in southern Fujian, as far as I could ever find. So yeah, there is this big sort of difference between those two drugs in particular, and the way I kind of tell the story of this particular location.
So then how does you kind of talk about how these drugs then get exported, I think, elsewhere in the region. I think there's a chapter on Singapore now, and how these drugs ended up having like brand names. And the idea that these drugs have like recognizable brands and logos, but then like how does, I guess, this export trade then kind of develop throughout the region, especially in places like Singapore?
Yeah, sure. So like the branding really starts in the 19th century. There's these key, the original kind of opium is Banaras and Patna, the Bengal opium, and then Malwa is the third Indian opium. And Banaras in particular Banaras and Patna in southern Fujian are really popular. Over time, Patna becomes really popular. Sorry, Banaras in the early 20th century. So like a lot of the branding revolves around trying to like capture that kind of elite market, right? That there's like rich people opium and poor people opium. And, you know, there's locally produced southern Fujianese opium that they're kind of mixing in as early as the 1830s. But if you get, once we're in the 20th century, right, there's a whole lot of sort of tastes and vintages, right? Everybody knows that this year of Banaras is way better. I had a consul refer to it as opiage, right? Like the year and location that it comes from. And so that stuff goes back a long ways. And then in the early 20th century, it's directly related to this phenomenon I sort of glossed a moment ago of centralization, getting rid of the tax farms in Southeast Asia. It starts in the Netherlands, Indies, and Vietnam. And then the British colonies follow suit. And so by 1905, 1910 or so, all across Southeast Asia now, there are centralized state monopolies that are only selling one brand of state opium. And for a lot of the Chinese diaspora, it's not what they want. And so that's I think where a lot of this stuff comes from is in places like Xiamen, ports with direct steamship connections to all those places in Southeast Asia, migrants, tens of thousands going every month, can subsidize their trip, can get set up there by bringing some of this stuff over. And so, right, the branding is really attractive, I think, to the consumers overseas. The sort of connection of migration and everything is right there. So yeah, that happens with opium, with cocaine as well. There's a really kind of fascinating branding story because it revolves around this brand Fujitsuru, which you can tell sort of sounds Japanese. But nobody could ever successfully trace it to Japan. And it was the most popular brand of cocaine sort of across India and Southeast Asia. And my hypothesis is it's a creation of South China, that it was just a fake brand. There were like four different labels that all kind of looked alike. And this is a place where you could get fake labels made pretty easily. and so yeah, cocaine as well sort of has this branding story.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You know, I mean, speaking of Japan, you know, one of the points where I had to stop in reading your book, because it was just a thing I'd never really thought about, was the role that the Taiwanese community played, whether or not people were actually Taiwanese or not. But just the idea of just the Taiwanese community and Taiwan being a hub for things like organized crime and drug production and smuggling is just like a weird thought to me, given, I mean, obviously what Taiwan is like today. But as you note, it's related to imperialism. It's related to Japan, sorry, Taiwan being a Japanese colony and extraterritoriality and all of this stuff. So how do all of these things interplay when it came to, I guess, the drugs trade and I guess the vice sector in general in China?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's some really fascinating new scholarship on this, out and coming out. So this is a topic that's getting more attention. You know, it stems from extraterritoriality, right? The foreign governments dating back to the Opium War had this right that they're citizens, when in China, would be subject to their own laws rather than China's laws as administered by their consular representatives in those places. So really, beginning after the Opium War, there was this immediate problem that neither the British or the Chinese foresaw, which is like, what about then all of these Chinese people who grow up in Singapore? And what happens if they come sort of quote unquote back to China? Are they British? Or are they Chinese? And that is that's one of the things I'm sort of working on here with this second project, is that original moment. So if you fast forward then to 1896, when the Meiji Japan and the Qing Empire have their war, and it gets settled, and Japan is granted Taiwan as a new colony, all of a sudden you've got tens of thousands of people who are going back and forth between what is now Japan and China, right? And what had been China and recently a province, you know, as of the 1870s, before that, a couple of prefectures of Fujian on the east coast of Taiwan. So, or the whatever. So anyways, after 1896, there's just this opportunity for tens and tens of thousands of people in coastal southern Fujian to sort of register and claim that they are Taiwanese and therefore Japanese imperial citizens. And why that's attractive is a lot of reasons. The Japanese consul is not as interested, I think, as the British consul in issues of like reputation. When Japanese citizens commit crimes in the city, the Japanese consuls don't seem to be all that worked up about it, right? They don't seem to feel the need to administer Japanese law on these people as harshly as they might in Japan, or as harshly as some of these British consuls wanted to administer British law on their populations. And so you said vice industry, right? The whole city gets taken over by these gangs, of some of them from Taiwan, some of them had never been to Taiwan but managed to sort of get citizenship or rent it from somebody. And so, yeah, prostitution, gambling, the sort of classic tax farms that most Chinese cities had get taken over by Taiwanese businessmen, as well as opium. And this is the sort of the most opportune. The timing is really good for these people because the 1920s, as they're sort of coming to power, these Taiwanese gangs within the city, this is when the city over and over again changes hands administratively. It's the warlord period of Chinese history. And the city is just, you know, one day, 1 year in the hands of this kind of Kuomintang naval commander. And then the next year somebody else takes it over. And each time that happens, it's an opportunity to renegotiate what they refer to as the Opium Suppression Bureau, which is what in the 1920s China was the state opium monopoly, and has operated like a tax farm, sold off to the highest bidder who could monopolize and control opium within the city. And so usually it's opium merchants doing this, and shamans often run through the city's chamber of commerce. And yeah, by the by 1925 or so, after 1925, every entity that bid on, successfully bid on and became sort of directors of opium prohibition bureaus in southern Fujian were Taiwanese, as well as people that warlords contracted with to collect taxes on opium poppy harvests in the countryside, which was another really lucrative tax farm.
So one more question on the history, and really, I mean, the end of this history. You know, how does how does this opium trading network end? I mean, because it's whatever network existed clearly doesn't exist today. So how does this network die off?
Yeah. In a lot of different ways, I guess. You know, World War II upsets a lot of networks, right? Upsets a lot of shipping lanes, upsets a lot of opportunities, all kinds of things like that, right? There's shifting blockades and things like that, right? Xiamen can't really be an entrepot to the world when it's Japanese and the surrounding counties are controlled by the Kuomintang, right? Because it was Xiamen's, that city's relationship to the surrounding counties that made it source of migration and things like that to other places. So like, that's just sort of one example, right, of how war kind of disrupts that stuff. And then in the aftermath of World War II, of course, is the Chinese Civil War. And so at the late 1940s, you know, the Kuomintang is setting about trying to arrest and prosecute everybody who worked with the Japanese. And that means lots and lots of opium traders. So it's really popular, you know, to identify who ran these opium monopolies for the Japanese puppet governments and stuff like that. So prosecuting drug people became really popular in the 1940s during the Civil War. And then, the communists, and this is here, I'm sort of out of my element, past my research timeline, but the communists shut it down. Is really when it ends in the 1950s. The Communist Party, is my understanding, up in Yan'an had done some similar to other kind of entities all across China in the 20s and 30s, taxed opium in certain ways up there. But by the time they were coming to power, I think that was over, is my understanding. And the way in which kind of international trade shut down also sort of contributed to this. It's also the moment when all of these Southeast Asian colonies that were saying, you know, we're going to centrally monopolize opium with the long-term goal of prohibition. A lot of times that long-term goal was kind of coming due around, you know, the 1940s. It's also across Southeast Asia, the moment of decolonization and the revolutionary governments taking over were fundamentally uninterested in having legal opium. So all of these things kind of came together.
So I think for my final question, you know, you mentioned in the introduction to your book, like it's very hard to study history of the opium business because of its kind of moral stain. Which of course persists today. I'm reminded of I remember when Richard Branson was had a campaign against Singapore executing someone accused of low-level drug smuggling, and Singapore's official response was basically, we're not going to listen to anybody who's from the UK, which peddled drugs during the Opium War. But anyway, I mean, that just shows that the moral stain of opium kind of continues to today. But how did that affect your ability to kind of research this as a historian? I mean, was it because of, I guess, all the shadiness around it? Was it difficult to actually kind of study material on this?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like even when the drug was legal, I found that it was treated in a lot of ways like an illegal trade. So like, especially like newspapers, you know, newspapers, these commercial newspapers of the late 19th and early 20th century, like really, people writing for those things cared about business, right? And they reported on business extensively. And when it comes to opium, they sort of like bit their tongue, right? All of it in Chinese, the term I kept coming up against in Shunbao, when they talk about, you know, I was trying to figure out who's buying the opium tax farms of the late 19th century, right? As they go up for auction, like who are the people bidding? Who wins the bid? And in Shunbao, which is like reporting on this stuff, they say Mo Shang, like a merchant, like anonymous merchant bid on it, right? Like they won't give people's names, even when it's legal. And then you have all these other periods when it's illegal, right? So it's people trying to keep secrets. So yeah, there's this question of like, are you only finding the incompetent ones or the unlucky ones? Are you, how can you tell the whole story? And it's really tricky, you know, thankfully, there was just so much kind of supporting documentation at each step of the way, right? Each chapter has its own sort of challenges, but like I was able to sort of triangulate in, I think, productive ways in each chapter between archives, between sources, right? So where I'd get certain information out of the Chinese government that would be really helpful, certain information out of the British government that would be really helpful. And I can tell a story with the two of those things that you can't with just one of them. So that's, you know, it does involve a lot of uncertainty, though.
Well, actually, maybe kind of one more question. I mean, at the end of your book, okay, you talked about kind of your introduction, but now about your conclusion, you know, there is this talk about, was it narco-capitalism, you know, drug smuggling networks in Latin America, South America, elsewhere in the world. I mean, did you notice any parallels in studying the opium trade during the 19th and early 20th centuries and the way people talk about drug smuggling networks today, whether in, again, Latin and South America or Central Asia or Southeast Asia or wherever we see drug smuggling networks today?
You know, I think there is like the thing that occurred to me at least was that there does seem to be a sort of like there are characteristics, there are patterns that develop in these sort of like places that become drug hotspots, right? So you think about like, there's a term in the discourse about Latin America called plaza, which is just sort of like when we're talking about the drug trade, it's like a city like El Paso on the border with Mexico where a huge amount of the drug trade gets funneled through, right? Like a choke point. I did have a lot of fun kind of thinking about Xiamen, this city in the late 19th and early 20th century. Like why did it sort of take on this role? And when did it take on this role? And it was really sort of like Xiamen wasn't important when the drug was legal in the second half of the 19th century. It was really important in the 1830s when it was illegal, and it became really important again after 1910 when it became illegal again. So like why and how was that the case? And how can that be compared to somewhere like, I don't know, the Golden Triangle today or certain parts of Central and South America. So that's, I think there's interesting kind of things to pursue. I also, you can't take things too far. You know, I'm a historian at heart, right? Context is everything. So I think it's, you know, there's interesting ways to sort of compare across these things, but I'm rooted in this particular story more than anything.
Well, I think that's a great place to end our conversation with Peter Thilly, author of The Opium Business, History of Crime and Capitalism in Maritime China. Peter, we actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? And what's next for you? What do you think the next project might be?
Where people can find my work, I don't have a centralized place for this. I think if you Google my name, you can probably get my work website. Supposedly, the University of Mississippi is launching a new website. I have a very outdated faculty profile right now with the incorrect title to this book that came out last year. So that is probably where you can find my work. What I'm working on next is maybe a more interesting question, hopefully at least. I'm really absorbed in the story about the small sword uprising. So a secret society uprising in the 1850s took over the city of Xiamen, where we've been talking about, as well as Shanghai, but had this kind of leadership that was diasporic. It came from folks who grew up in Singapore, really this kind of first generation of people who grew up in Singapore, and then the aftermath of the Opium War happened, and they had opportunities to go to their kind of ancestral homeland where they'd never been, and find jobs that were particular to their skill sets. So, you know, people who were the linguist for the British consul, right? Walking around with the British consul, translating with local people, right? Because they could speak Malay and they could speak Southern Fujianese. So people who had that job, people who worked for these opium firms doing the similar type of thing, those were the leaders of this uprising. And they were kind of using this revival of the Ming Dynasty language that other secret societies used at the time, but they were clearly sort of different. So I'm really sort of getting into the question of like, who were they? What did they want? Like, what did they envision creating with this uprising? What was the kind of state? I'm still sort of puzzled by like what the end game was with this uprising. So that's how I'm reading the sources right now.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at Nick R.I. Gordon. That's NickRiGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. We're on our favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Tanvi Srivastava and her translation of The War Diary of Ashasan, from Tokyo to Netaji's Indian National Army. But before then, Peter, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Nicholas. This is my pleasure.